wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's now time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this May 18th Monday. I want to thank the dedicated KBOO staff who have, for these last few weeks, kept the amazing radio produced for our community on the air. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks to Ted Levine, a nurse in New York City, and a rank-and-file activist and spokesperson for nurses in New York City hospitals. In part two of this two-part interview, Bill and Ted discuss what nurses can do in their workplaces and in politics to transform the medical system for the benefit of its workers and for its patients and the public, particularly minorities and the poor. In our new Old Mole segment on public health and the pandemic, Jan Hocken and Patricia Kohlberg follow the race for a coronavirus vaccine and some of the misleading claims circulating in the media. They also discuss ways of looking at infectious diseases from the public health versus medical model perspectives. Patricia Kohlberg is a retired primary care physician and public health official who served for 2 decades as the medical director of Multnomah County Health Department. She has written for both the lay and academic press about various aspects of medicine and public health. We'll conclude this morning's show with a segment from the archive. Appearing at the Troublemakers School in Portland, Oregon, April 2019, Barbara Mataloni discussed the national picture of public school teachers organizing and how and why strikes work. Mataloni is the education director at Labor Notes. She recently served as president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association and is a longtime writer and educator. This discussion is more timely than ever as working people in public and private sector face deepening austerity measures in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. And remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm, Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Ted Levine.
Hi, Ted Levine. Welcome again to KBOO.
Glad to be back with you, Bill.
Ted Levine is a nurse in New York. He's been living the COVID epidemic in New York City, working throughout his hospital, much in the COVID wards and the hellish conditions without proper protective equipment, without enough ventilators, comforting patients, watching people die, including some of his fellow nurses. He himself got infected a week or more of another kind of hell, but recovered, then was called back to work. He's a union activist, became a spokesperson at nurse rallies and with media. This is the second of a two-part interview. Last week, we discussed what's happening to nursing and the profession over the last several months. Like Ted, for many, it's been even more heartbreaking and exhausting and fearing for their lives and their families' lives. But going through hell, they've learned a lot, saw the disparities and deficiencies of the U.S. medical system as mostly the poor and vulnerable died. So they were being asked to risk their lives because of gross cutbacks of funding for public health, for hospital preparation. And it was clear why, because the elites running the economic and medical system and were dominant in political decision-making, they were most interested in reducing their taxes and building up the military, police, and prisons. So while others were dying and nurses and all essential workers risking their lives, the elites were sheltering in place, working from offices and luxurious apartments and country homes, making life and death decisions about others. Still with all that, the nurses, they also felt the great respect and appreciation and love they were receiving from the people in this country for their skills, for their selfless efforts, for risking their lives out of commitment to their patients and to the profession, to public service. And gaining that public respect and appreciation, nurses and all the, and their allies and other health workers, the many health workers, essential workers in the whole health system, they gain pride and confidence in themselves. From being invisible, they become essential and greatly appreciated. This all creates great organizing and political potentials for changing lots of American systems, not just the medical systems. Had lots of lefties, political pundits, see COVID and this period offering transformative opportunities. So could COVID and the problems of our medical system create the forces to reconstruct that system, maybe even winning universal single-payer Medicare for all, among many other things? So, Ted, let's discuss that political potential. What do you see nurses and their many allies fighting for?
Well, the crisis certainly lays bare the inadequacy of the current system as it's constructed to deal with this sort of a thing. So many things need to change, and it's not just around healthcare. Broader social changes are necessary in order for us to be able to confront this crisis. Certainly things like single-payer healthcare. People are worried that they're not going to be able to pay for a medical appointment. They're going to delay going. Their illness is going to get worse. Other people are going to be exposed, and the pandemic spreads. Certainly real universal healthcare beyond the kind of false promise of Obamacare and things like that is essential. And nurses have been on the front lines of fighting for universal healthcare, single-payer, for decades, and continue to do so, and I think in a heightened way, or at least there's the potential for a heightened level of struggle in this crisis and in response to the crisis. But also, it raises much broader social and economic issues. So if people are relying on their income and there's no adequate social replacement for lost income, they're going to go out and work. It's absurd and cruel to expect that people will not go out and work. You know, there's so many people who work in the informal economy who have that option. There's a lot of pressure on construction. There are unclear definitions of what's essential construction. In many states, the political authorities are outright telling people to go back to work. So social distancing is not working to nearly the extent that it should, because we're not replacing lost income or people who are living paycheck to paycheck. So something like a social wage or a real replacement of lost income for people who should be staying at homes is essential. And at least some nurses are starting to call for that in collective ways.
A lot of that is organizing great coalitions, but organizing for the kind of state that is to replace the people who are now running the state, with a great number of people who are at least have social democratic inclinations, who have a sense that there should be a decent safety net for everybody and jobs for all at a living wage, if we can get a state of that kind. So nurses do work in the sort of the legislative arena, and they do a lot of work there. Is that right?
Well, certainly. It has the limitations that legislative work suffers from that we know about. It tends to be very much focused on lobbying. And so the vast majority of that work is done by union staff or elected leaders in the higher offices. But there are certainly nurses who are getting involved at a rank and file and grassroots level through campaigns that are organized by the unions and through other organizations going out and speaking to the media, engaging in public protests to raise awareness about the need for greater and far-reaching legislative action. It's about lost income for workers who are sheltering in place, and also about a real robust public health response, the kind of thing that you've seen in other countries with extensive testing, contact tracing, quarantine, providing for the people who are in quarantine for their needs in terms of food and laundry and medication and other things. That type of a program requires millions of people. So that's an opportunity as well to stimulate the economy in a way that is pro-working class, in a way that promotes greater equality. People who have been laid off, who have lost their jobs, can be trained and put to work doing some of these tasks. And it's just going to take so many people. So that's one of the things that certainly I've been advocating for, and I know that my union has started advocating for, and that's going to have to be part of the fight. There's no way we're getting out of this without a really dramatic change in direction in terms of how the government is managing the pandemic.
This is Cable Radio, Bill Resnick for the Omaha Variety Hour. Talk to Ted Levine, a nurse in New York City, living the hell of the COVID epidemic. Like other nurses, though, he is also feeling the appreciation and respect that nurses have gained for their commitment, risking their lives. And Ted, so far in this interview, we've been discussing the nurses' union and its struggles to change our basic economic and political system towards supporting working class people. Ted, it seems to me that the COVID epidemic and its impact on nurses across the country who are watching places like New York City and so many other places around the world and in the United States, and will be getting more involved as COVID comes to their communities and they see what's happening. It seems to me it's a tremendous opportunity for organizing a much more powerful nurses movement based in the nurses' union. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think one key to organizing a more powerful movement is for nurses and any workers to believe that there's something big at stake, something so important that it's worth sacrificing time for, taking risks for, and just focusing their energy on in times when their energy is so scarce and it's at such a low point. I think the nature of this crisis, the things that we're up against are so great and so important that they present that potential. And you're starting to see nurses willing to take risks. Nurses are speaking out to the media despite hospital policies that limit our free speech, or at least purport to limit our free speech. You see nurses going out and protesting, and at a time when there's not very much in the way of public protest, or at least there wasn't initially. We're sort of breaking the ice there. So you're starting to see cracks in the edifice, but we certainly have a long way to go. There's no guarantee that this movement explodes in the way that it needs to make this kind of a change. That's certainly the hope. And I think that people are not yet seeing the depth and the seriousness of the multiple crises that we're facing and that are going to deepen as this goes on. A lot of people are starting to see, in a place like New York where I work, the number of cases has gone down dramatically. Things in the hospitals are quieting down. People are not feeling so stretched. So I think there's a certain level of fatigue, and there's a kind of willingness to believe that, well, it's going to keep getting better and things are going to go back to normal. But when people take a step back and look at the big picture and they see, well, the only reason these cases have gone down is because of extreme social distancing measures. And as we relax those measures, we're going to see the number of cases go back up again. And the economic hit is going to be even harder in a lot of cases. Businesses that have been stretched are going to collapse when they have to close again. People who have been stretched are going to be in absolute crisis, not able to make the rent, not able to pay the mortgage, not able to buy food. And then at the same time, we have government leaders like Cuomo in New York State who are taking advantage of the crisis to push an austerity agenda, pushing for deep, devastating cuts to public higher education and K-12 education as well. I think that we're going to see a growing awareness of the fact that we're in a crisis of our lives, of our lifetimes, and it's going to be worse than most people anticipate or see at this point. The hope is that as that happens, there's going to be a greater willingness to do the work, to organize coworkers, to push ourselves and each other to go out and fight, to take more risks and more dramatic action, to stand up to government and capital in order to get what we need, in order to stop them from just devastating the public sector, which is what they're trying to do now.
This is Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Ted Levine, a New York nurse. We've been talking about the gain in political power and confidence, political power, public appreciation of nurses, and the possibilities of really entering the political combat for a different kind of state and a different kind of medical system. Yet nurses also basically been in subordinate positions in hospitals, answering to a hierarchy of executives, the nurses and other staff, do all the frontline work. Still, there's a sense that the doctors lead and make the decisions, and often poor decisions, and the nurses recognize it. That happened in Portland during a strike. Nurses fought OHSU, Oregon Health Sciences University. I became very friendly with one of the nurses in the preemie ward, and she told her story that they sent in new doctors now and then, some interns, and the nurses knew so much more, some of them working there like her 30 years, about what you should do for the various kinds of preemies and the various machines and therapies and the way you deal with parents and the little babies. And they had to teach the doctors, but they found that over the years, doctors became much more amenable to listen to nurses. And in fact, the strike wasn't about that, although it was about nurse power. It seems to me that this is an opportunity for the nurses to, in fact, assert themselves in ways in changing their position in the hospitals and creating far more sort of democratically operating teams and recognizing nurse capacity and really democratizing the nursing system, particularly chronic disease care, which is about 70% of what at least of medical expenses in this country goes to, like diabetes and heart disease and cancer now is a chronic disease, not just instant death. Tell us about that, the effort by nurses to gain respect and to, in fact, be able to do their jobs without being subordinate. Tell us about that.
No, I would make a distinction between frontline doctors and, you know, in the executive offices running the hospital. I think that certainly there's a tension and there's always a struggle for respect and for our insight to be taken seriously. But at the same time, it's really a joke among many doctors, particularly, you know, the first year residents. They're in on the joke that really the nurses are teaching residents. And it's something you don't just hear from nurses, you hear it from doctors. So there's a kind of a hierarchy there, but there's also a recognition that we're working together on the front lines. And the truth is we get a lot of respect from doctors, although there certainly are plenty of examples of disrespect that people can point to. So I don't want to paint the picture as nurses good, doctors bad, or nurses subordinate, doctors dominant. I don't think that's really the way it's working nowadays. And the truth is that the doctors in hospitals have been very much proletarianized. They don't have the power and independence that you sort of imagine. I mean, they're independent providers, but there's a lot about their working conditions that creates a sense that they are also cogs in a machine. There are a lot of opportunities for solidarity between doctors, particularly the residents and interns and nurses. I will say that in this crisis, nurses are often left alone to take care of patients and make decisions. They're in the room by themselves, and there's a reluctance with some good public health justifications, reluctance for doctors to spend too much time in the rooms. But what that means is that nurses are picking up the slack, and they're in the rooms with the patients. They're the ones exposed. But you can see the potential for nurses to have more independent judgment in how they're caring for their patients, because there's less people kind of looking over their shoulders. It's sort of the nature of the crisis when resources are scarce, not just frontline resources, but also managerial resources. They can't keep on top of it. That creates problems, but it creates a certain kind of space for nurses to exercise their own judgment and expand their capacity, make good decisions, to have confidence in their decisions. Certainly, you know, I don't want to imply that nurses are prescribing medications or giving a different dose than the ordered dose and things like that. That's not the sort of thing I'm talking about. You know, we're not practicing outside of our scope of practice, but there are many, many opportunities for nurses to make decisions that affect care and patient outcomes for the better. And that's really what I was emphasizing.
The point I was making was about chronic disease care. The systems, like of diabetes control, they're still dominated by doctors and pay-for-service. And the people who are working with patients and the families to help them manage their disease better, to do exercises like in diabetes, to exercise every day, to watch their diet, how that can be done, where they can get services to help them. All of those things are shorted because so many of the physicians don't take part in it, and yet the people who are supposed to do it, the social workers and the nurses in the hospitals, it's not a sufficient priority. And the hospitals make money on the surgeries for dealing with the eye problems and the infection and the feet problems and the amputations of people with diabetes can go on for years and years of slicing away at people at huge profits to the hospital. It's not good for the family or the patients. It seems to me in most of those long-term diseases, the medical parts are really subordinate to the social parts. And it's the nurses and the social workers and others who, in fact, do those things. And their role in it is just not sufficiently appreciated. That's where it seems to me nurses and social workers and the rest have to exert themselves to become much more important in creating care teams rather than, you know, medical technique. And unnecessary medical care is the major way of dealing with some of the problems. Kidney disease and so many others, they're controllable. Does that make sense to you?
You know, I work in a hospital setting, but I would say that certainly in this crisis, many of the activities, the essential activities that nurses and social workers do to prepare patients with chronic illnesses to be discharged safely, to take care of their own needs, I would imagine that many of those activities are suffering because in a lot of cases we're strapped. Certainly during the peak in my state, when we were just trying to stay afloat, running around, and nurses were just trying to do the most essential things to keep their patients alive, some of the teaching, I would imagine, has been, if not eliminated, at least not been done to the same degree that it could have under normal times. You know, this kind of goes back to a question that we haven't touched on, but that I think is really key, which is the issue of staffing. Staffing has always been a problem, and we've been struggling for years to improve staffing in the hospitals to ensure that there are enough nurses to safely and effectively take care of the patients that we have. And we fought for this in our last contract struggle and continue to fight for it. The issue of staffing has really come out clearly as a result of this pandemic, because during the height, certainly, the hospital was overwhelmed because we were already short-staffed. You know, unit after unit already had not enough staff available to meet the needs. And then when we have this flood of patients coming in, new units opening up, people being moved around. So many units we were hearing were working even shorter than before at a time when the need for staffing was so much greater. The short staffing situation that already existed was kind of a setup for disastrous short staffing in the height of the crisis. And then by the same token, as the number of cases has gone down, nurses are learning what it really feels like on some units to have adequate numbers of staff. You know, management is calling it being overstaffed, but in some cases, what they're calling overstaffed is staffing at the level that they've agreed to contractually, or staffing certainly at the level that nurses think is required to take care of our patients under normal circumstances. So nurses are getting a taste of it. They're seeing that it's possible. Hospitals have managed with the right motivation to have enough staff to really take care of patients the way they should be taken care of. My hope is that translates into push for really adequate staffing, even in normal times. And that will certainly have an impact on patients with chronic illnesses. When we're short staffed, things like patient teaching really are first things to go, because we need to make sure certainly that we're getting to the patients who are in life and death situations first. Patients are getting their medications. Patients are getting the things that are urgently needed. The patient teaching and the discharge planning that are needed to make sure that be able to take care of themselves or be taken care of for the long haul after they leave the hospital, those are among the first things to go when we don't have enough resources, enough people, and enough time. So I think that staffing is really the crux of it when it comes to addressing these chronic illnesses that you're talking about and addressing them in a longer-term way and not just dealing with the immediate urgency.
Ted Levine, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure.
Next on The Old Mole, we launch our new mole segment on public health and the pandemic. Jan Hocken and Patricia Kohlberg will discuss this morning ways of looking at infectious diseases from a public health versus medical model perspective.
This is Jan Hocken and Patricia Kohlberg, focusing today on the public health response to the pandemic and what's been lacking or overlooked. Much of the news on the pandemic traces the race for a vaccine with vast investments and resources in this new mad dash for what is held out as the only reliable path out of the pandemic. Well, Patricia, as a physician and public health professional, what's your assessment of the various claims circulating around vaccines and their hopes and promises, and what we can draw from the history of vaccination and immunization programs?
First, let me say good morning, Jan. I'm really happy that you invited me to have this discussion because these are issues I've thought about for a long time. And what I'd like to start with is my reflection on something that I read in a public health blog about understanding vaccines. And there was a statement that they made in there, and I'll just read it to you. There is no working vaccine for HIV, malaria, or tuberculosis. Consequently, these diseases continue to kill millions in the world. Now, I find that a very misleading and almost untrue statement. I want to say first that I am not an anti-vaxxer. I believe very much in vaccination as a very important public health tool. But the fact that we don't have vaccines for this trio of diseases is not the reason for their not being controlled. It's really all about the social conditions under which these diseases flourish. And things like poverty and hygiene and poor access to medical care are the reasons why TB, HIV, and malaria are still with us. So let's go back in history a little bit more, maybe to the 16th century England. And the records indicate perhaps up to a third of all kids perished by the age of 15, and they were dying from infectious diseases like dysentery, scarlet fever, whooping cough, influenza, smallpox, pneumonia, and clearly kids aren't dying like that now. If you go back just a century or 120 years ago in this country to the 1900s, the three leading causes of death were tuberculosis, pneumonia, and dysentery. Today, obviously, that's not true. The leading causes of mortality are heart disease and cancer. But what happened in between to defeat infectious disease was not immunization programs. It was all the classic public health measures, and it had to do primarily with living conditions, hygiene, housing, nutrition, clean water. If you look at the line of infectious disease cases as it's going down over time, you find that that line starts to go down long before there were any immunizations introduced. And then in mid-20th century, when the immunizations are programs start to be introduced, you see another little downward dive, but it's minimal compared to the effects that these classic public health measures had on controlling infectious disease.
Maybe we can talk some as little later about why these public health measures have often been marginalized. It's what Ivan Illich, the sociologist who wrote so much about the history of medicine, called shadow labor, the kind of work that you only see when it's not being done.
Right.
And so
right.
much of public health we're seeing now, because ordinarily these are programs that are kind of assumed in a way, but have been underfunded versus the medical system that is impressive in many ways around specialty and the technology-driven
right.
aspects of healthcare, but is lacking, as we know, in many other areas. How would you situate this issue of vaccines and immunizations within the healthcare system versus the public health system? And how would you compare those two models for looking at wellness and illness?
Well, let's just take the COVID, the current pandemic. I think that it's very obvious what is needed now to control the spread of COVID. There's widespread agreement on this, are the classic public health measures. But because of
just briefly say what may not be obvious, but what are those main principles that have been established for some time? Would you agree?
Oh, yeah. 90% of the transmission of COVID is occurring in closed indoor spaces. So we're talking about prisons. We're talking about call centers. We're talking about big workplaces like meatpacking plants. We're talking about detention centers, homeless shelters,
nursing homes,
all those places where people are confined indoors and breathing the same air over long periods of time. And the way that you control that, of course, is through social distancing, it's through managing airflow, it's through wearing masks, it's by decreasing the density of those populations. Those are the classic public health measures. And there are other things like just the general health of the population. When your nutritional status is poor, when you have a lot of underlying disease because of exposure to pollution, et cetera, then you're going to have more infections, and people are not going to do as well with those infections.
Is this also related to the vaccine controversies, in that public health also takes a more socialized view of our health and well-being, that what we do affects others? The vaccination is about vaccinating your kids is a commitment to the larger good. And
precisely. Medical
model tends to be more focused on the individual and an immediate set of determinants to illness.
When you talk about the project of medicine, you're talking about taking care of an individual patient. And the questions that you're asking yourself as a doctor or a nurse or whatever is, what is making this person sick? What can this person do to be healthier? What treatments are appropriate for this person? You might think a little bit about prevention, but that's not the strong suit of medicine. So the point of view of medicine is that disease comes out of bad genes, bad behavior, and bad luck. And it's all about marshaling the forces of medical science to save people, sometimes from themselves. And that's the kind of thinking that is coming to the fore now in the face of this pandemic. What's going to be the best treatment? What's going to be the best ventilator? When are we going to have our vaccine, et cetera? But we find that medical care approach doesn't work very well. And there's pretty broad agreement in the literature that if you're talking about excess morbidity and mortality, which is a fancy phrase for preventable disease and death, then medical care accounts for about 10% of preventing that excess morbidity and mortality. That's not very much.
Are you saying also with the coronavirus?
I think that's probably true also of the coronavirus, although treatment, once people get the disease, medical science, of course, is extremely important. But the percentage of cases that actually get to a hospital and need treatment is pretty tiny. It's hard to know because so many patients, so many people with the disease are asymptomatic, and we really don't know how many have been infected. It's hard to know what percentage wind up needing treatment. So it's hard to guess about that.
There seems to be a tremendous focus on the acute care of people who are very ill on ventilators and either die or require emergency intensive care. And then on the other end of the spectrum are these asymptomatic, perhaps super spreaders who seem not ill at all. There's very little that I've seen on where to locate people between those two extremes. And is that important? I mean, there are people who might be mildly sick.
Yeah, there probably is a huge reservoir of people who are mildly sick. Some people are estimating that up to 40% of the infections are asymptomatic and that therefore spreading the disease without knowing it.
With and just of course, low-level symptoms that even with this now, the pandemic are still contagious, but don't become critically ill for a number of reasons related to underlying vulnerabilities.
I think actually from a transmission point of view, the more important issue or problem is the people who do get sick, but in the 2 or 3 days leading up to when they get sick, their viral loads in their blood, in their lungs, or whatever is rising and rising. And right as they become ill, their viral loads are at their peak, very large. And that is when they are really most contagious. And it's probably those folks who get sick who are doing more of the spreading because they're around people. They don't know they're sick, and people don't know that recognize that they're sick. And so they're spreading it during that period. People who don't really get sick may not be as infectious, but this is not something that we really know.
How would you address these patterns of transmission from a public health standpoint, and what are some of the dynamics in the capitalist economy where we're living this out that affect these patterns of transmission and infection?
Right. Well, I think you have to go back to basic principles of public health, and that's the case identification, the contact tracing, the testing, and all of that is a mess. It's been poorly handled right from the get-go. And we can talk a little bit about all of that, but I think it's been pretty well covered in the mainstream media. I would like to get on to that question about why the public health response has been so attenuated and why people are grasping on to that techno fix, that hope for a vaccine, etc. And I think a big reason behind that is that the fortunes of public health have been declining in this country for well over 2 or 3 decades. Most recently, we saw Trump, for example, 2 months before the coronavirus was thought to break out in Wuhan, he ended a $200 million pandemic early warning program that was aimed at training scientists in China and other countries to detect and respond to exactly this kind of threat. And they had, in the couple of decades that they had operated, they had identified 1,200 viruses with the potential to leap over into the human population and cause a pandemic. More recently, Trump proposed a federal budget that was going to cut $25 million from public health preparedness and response. But I think it's a real mistake to think that Trump is the problem here, because this cutting back on public health and public health preparedness has been going on really since the Reagan era, which is when we first saw that radical return to the logic of the market that was characterized by deregulation of industry, defunding of the public sphere, the privatization of public services, the undermining of worker rights. And it is at this point when you start to see a decline year after year after year in public health spending. And that accelerated even after 2008, and this is during the Obama administration. So you end up with a situation today where public health spending is 2.5% of all the healthcare spending in the U.S., which is sort of to me, a shocking figure. Just to put that in another context, the U.S. military budget exceeds the budget of the CDC by a factor of about 130 times. So the U.S. was really caught flat-footed when it faced this pandemic. You had cuts at every single level, the local, state, and federal level in public health, in the public health infrastructure, ability to respond quickly and massively and appropriately to this pandemic.
Well, given that the economic imperatives driving the healthcare system and starving public health initiatives, what about now the race for a vaccine? On the one hand, many of the vaccines that have failed, and with Ebola, there was a limited effort because the pharmaceutical companies didn't think it was worth the investment. But there is a lot of capital going into this search for a vaccine. It will likely be profitable.
So oh, yeah.
How do we reclaim public health from the profit-driven institutions and corporations and even entities within our own government that collude in this form of inequality?
Well, I think that's an opportunity that we actually have within the context of this pandemic, because I think the pandemic has torn some of the clothes off the emperor, as they say. And it's an opportunity to point out that a very debilitated public health system has not served us well. And it's debilitated because it's part of big government. I think it's also debilitated because it has that potential to expose the externalities of commercial and industrial processes. And big companies don't want to have to be responsible for the public health problems that they create. Public health represents the commons, and public health problems require sweeping policy changes and big investments, and that is anathema to the current powers that be. So we have an opportunity now, I think, to point out within the context of this pandemic the very real price that we pay for that debilitation of our public health services.
And that what you're describing is more than just access to health care, Medicare for all.
Oh, absolutely. No, we need to vastly beef up our public health systems from every level, from the local health departments who are responsible for doing things like contact tracing, to the state level and emergency preparedness, to the CDC, to the international level. We have the capacity to detect these viruses before they leap over into the human community, and that's what we should be doing. But we're not funding that activity anymore.
Well, let's perhaps take that up and see what we can understand about that potential for prevention that's always part of the public health model, or it's central to the public health model. So let's continue with this story of the pandemic through the lens of public health and what the openings are through this crisis and what we have to keep an eye on as we organize for a healthy return to normalcy.
Well, I think we're in a situation where the public has really lost confidence in the ability of this system to protect and preserve their health. So it's a very interesting moment. So what I would like to talk more about is a few different themes. One is that scientific progress is not the same as social progress, and that scientific progress by itself is not going to save us. I also think that I want to point out that healthcare systems reflect the social relations of the larger society, and that those healthcare systems are going to succeed and fail in exactly the same ways. And lastly, I think building healthy communities is fundamental to the project of remaking our societies into ones that privilege the health and well-being of the people over the well-being of capital. So some of those are some of the things that I'd like to explore as we talk further.
Okay, let's do it. This is Jan Hocken and Patricia Kohlberg talking today about the public health response to the pandemic and how we need to organize for a better response.
We conclude this morning's program with a discussion by Barbara Mattaloni at last year's April 2019 Troublemakers School put on by Labor Notes here in Portland, Oregon. The discussion surrounded public school teachers organizing and how and why strikes work. But of course, in these times, as we face ever-increasing austerity measures in response to COVID-19, working people can take these lessons into their own workplaces.
Hi, good morning, sisters and brothers. So excited to be here. So first, in terms of the broader context that we're experiencing, is that we've been dealing with an intense pressure to privatize the public good. We feel that every day. We see it in transportation, we see it in healthcare, we see it everywhere. Is first of all to insist on a scarcity budget. That we use the word austerity, and the idea is there's just not enough money out there to fund our public schools, our public transportation, public health care. Now, we all know that's a lie. You know, we remain one of the wealthiest countries in the world, and it's really become sort of just accepted as part of the narrative that we just don't have the money, because they're not just interested in underfunding it, but they want to create a narrative that says that it should be underfunded because they want to destroy it, is that they use testing as a weapon to prove that students are unable to perform, that teachers are not doing a good job, that schools are failing. Charter schools are a key piece of the alternative that they offer to say, see, public isn't working, so we need to go private. And really, charter schools, you know, depending on where you are, in Massachusetts, we were able to successfully beat down a ballot question that would have raised the cap on charter schools. But if you're in places like Chicago, like LA, like New Orleans, Philadelphia, charter schools are taking over the public schools. And they're doing that, like, literally. Because as much as charter schools are about undermining public education, they're also about a land grab. They're about taking property from the public good and using that property for private interests. And what you see happening in Chicago is they close public schools, they maybe put a charter school in, and maybe they actually convert that into gentrified housing so they can push the black and brown people out. I think about how abstract that can seem. We're talking about large forces at work, about austerity and this and that. But the reality for educators, you feel the austerity budget. You feel the larger class sizes. You feel the work intensification. You feel the narrowing of your curriculum and your capacity to act towards your best ideals as an educator and what brought you into this work. You feel your students who are struggling. It's a visceral experience every day. When I was president of the MTA, I would talk to teachers and they would say to me, the question is, do I cry in the morning or do I cry at the end of the day? Do I cry before I go into work because it's just too much? Or do I cry at the end of the day because it's been too much? This is a material reality that people are experiencing every day. And that's a key part, I think, of why we're finally, people are fed up. Because the bad guys have gone too far. And people who sort of thought, well, this is just the way the world is, are starting to go, it's not okay that this is what the world is. You know, we come into this work with a set of ideals and hopes and possibilities. And to see those crushed every day, people are really ready to say, it's enough. Now, if you look over the past year and a half, there are sort of two different things that have happened that have led to the strikes. We have the sort of red state revolt, and we have the blue state organizing to push back against the Democrats who've been selling us down the river for years and years. But, you know, a lot of that also has to do with whether or not you actually have collective bargaining. So how these strikes were structured is really important. But in Chicago in 2012, in UTLA just this spring, in Oakland this spring, in Denver, I'm sure in where you were working within the context of the union and the union leadership to say we need to organize ourselves for a strike and we need to set up networks and we are going to use the union resources to do that. In West Virginia, in Oklahoma, in Arizona, it did not come from the union leadership. In West Virginia, the union leadership eventually was like, oh, there's a parade. You know, they're like running with the banner to get out in front of it and call it theirs. But the West Virginia teachers started their organizing because they started just talking to each other. And in fact, I'll tell you, like I know from talking to the leaders of the strike down there, the union leadership actually brought them into rooms and said, cut it out. We got it taken care of. We have a relationship with the legislators, right? You all know about those relationships and how effective they are. It's happening right now in Oregon, right? You got a supermajority, and they're cutting, their budget is less. I mean, that's how good that works, right? So they organize themselves. They did incredible work with their strike prep, making sure that the students were going to be taken care of. They went out and they talked to churches and community centers, and they said, our kids have to be fed, because something like 80 to 90% of those kids in West Virginia only get their food from the school. So they brought the community in. They go out and strike, and then the leadership of the three unions go talk to the legislators, and they come back after 5 days, and they say, we've got a deal. We're going to get a 5% salary increase for teachers and paraprofessionals, support staff, and we're going to get a 3% for public sector workers, because the teachers had said, this is about public sector workers, about all of us. Isn't that great? And they said back to the table, they refused to settle until everybody got 5%. Mm-hmm. So that's the nature, the solidarity that they built and their political consciousness about what they were fighting for, both in the coalitions with the parents and taking care of the kids and refusing to settle until everybody was going to get something. So what do we learn from these strikes, though? Because even though they're very structurally different, Arizona, West Virginia, Oklahoma, really rank and file. And UTLA, Chicago, Oakland are examples here of structured leadership developed. But here's some things I think are true for everybody. These strikes are about teaching members to access their power. And we don't talk about power enough. We need to think about our power and bring it into our consciousness, and we need to give people opportunities to experience their power on a regular basis. When people act collectively in the smallest way that we first ask them to act, that changes them. When you walk into a room and everybody's got a red shirt on, you're a different person in that room than you were when you were in your classroom alone. All of these strikes are successful because they talk to the community and they have the community on their side. West Virginia put public sector unions demands on the table, not just teachers. They developed some sort of political consciousness and connections in their work. In West Virginia, people started going, well, where is the money? And then they're like, oh, it's over there and all those tax exemptions that the gas and oil company get. That's where the money is. And so people started to see the political structures and be able to speak back against the austerity stuff. But I think really, really important is that they built connections with each other. It wasn't top down. It was, we're going to bring you together in a room, we're going to talk about our issues, we're going to develop an analysis, we're going to understand our power, and we're going to use that power to fight back. Strikes work, and we win, but they don't change the world, like right away, right? We did not destroy capitalism in LA and create a new socialist city. I mean, we just didn't get there. And, you know, but I'm a little disappointed.
I hear it all the time.
But it's really important because people are going to, like, you put so much energy into the strike and you feel your power, and then the world still needs you to continue to act and change. And the things we need to help us do that I've seen in the strikes is these relationships that sustain us and a political analysis that you're not just fighting one boss, you're fighting the whole idea of a boss. And when we know that, we'll understand why after we win, the boss can come back and hit us so damn hard. Mm-hmm. But we know that that's because we're powerful, not because we're weak. Thank you.
It is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. Thanks to our Old Mole contributors and guests this morning. I'm Denise Morris. I've been your host. Remember, you can find the Old Mole, this program, and programs in our archive at KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And we will see you again next week.